Perimeter Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you this evening. It's another wonderful perimeter and proof that the universe still matters to a large number of people. Tonight it's my great pleasure and privilege to introduce our speaker, Robert Brandenburger. Robert was educated at ETH in Zurich and Harvard University, where he received his PhD. He was a Sloan Foundation Fellow and a DOE Outstanding Junior Achiever. He did postdoctoral fellowships at Santa Barbara at the Institute of Theoretical Physics and Cambridge University, and began as a professor at Brown University of Faculty Positions since 1987. And we are particularly delighted to have Robert at Perimeter Institute as a visitor from now until about 6 months or so from now. So it's wonderful to have Robert here. He is a cosmologist and an astrophysicist of note, and a wonderful teacher and educator as well as researcher. And I'd like you to give Robert a round of applause. And,
can you hear me? So thank you, Howard, for the invitation to speak. I must confess that I've never spoken to an audience this large. It's quite a challenge. It's also going to be a challenge to keep my voice, because I've just come over a very bad cold. Now, I'd like to thank all of you in the audience for braving the cold and the ice tonight to come and listen. Now, all of you who are younger than I am probably learned in school, or were told in school, that the universe started with a Big Bang. And a lot of you have probably read recent popular science articles stating that the Big Bang theory has been confirmed by observations. So tonight, I plan to talk about early universe cosmology. And I hope to convince you that we have indeed learned a lot about the early universe. We've learned a lot about the structure on very large scales that we observe today. In fact, we have learned more than what people 25 years ago believed would ever be possible to learn. However, the more we learn, the more questions appear, and the more cherished beliefs we must question. And I'll also try to persuade you that it's now time to question the very existence of the Big Bang. I will not be able to give you an answer, but I will leave you with questions. So, this is the title of my talk, Was There a Big Bang? And this talk is about cosmology. Cosmology has two main goals. And its first goal is to understand the structure of the universe on large scales. This is quantitative science. It's beautiful science. I will show you that there are beautiful pictures of the universe on large scales. The second goal of cosmology is to learn about the history of the very early universe. Now, this may sound to you as very speculative as opposed to quantitative. It may seem to you like a philosophical endeavor. However, in the context of our modern theories, these two questions, one and two, are very closely connected. And to me, this connection is what makes the field of cosmology so exciting. We move back and forth between speculative ideas in the very old universe and things that we can measure and test in terms of the large-scale structure. So the first thing I need to do is to convince you how big the universe actually is. I hope you can vaguely identify this picture as a spiral galaxy. It's a beautiful spiral galaxy. This spiral galaxy happens to be M51. probably seen galaxies through telescopes, and more of you have seen pictures like this in books and articles. Now, a galaxy is a huge object. It is so big that we have to measure distances, not in terms of kilometers or miles, but in terms of light years. So a light year is the distance that light travels in 1 year. And you all know that light travels incredibly fast. So 1 light year is an incredibly long distance. It is about 10 to the 13 kilometers. So you write a 1 followed by 13 zeros, that many kilometers. That's a light year. An incredible length. Now this galaxy is not just 1 light year, but it is about 100,000 light years in this direction and in this direction. And this spiral disk is maybe 3,000 light years thick. So 3,000 light years plus 100,000 plus 100,000 light years. It's an enormous object. This galaxy contains maybe 10 billion stars. And on such a picture, it looks like a compact object. However, if you go into the galaxy and you measure the distance between the closest stars, then you find that typically the distance between the closest stars is about 1 light year. So galaxies are huge objects. However, in terms of what we study today, in terms of large-scale structure of the universe, a galaxy is tiny. And a galaxy is so tiny that I will replace the whole galaxy by a single point in the maps that I will show you later. So the entire observable universe is 10 billion light years wide. 10 billion light years. And over the past decade, we've obtained increasingly deep and wide maps of the distribution of galaxies. And I will now show you a couple of these maps. Now, there's one thing which I plan to do on the board, but since there's so many of you here and so many of you sitting in the back, you won't see anything that I write on the board, so I'll do it on the transparency. So it is astronomers who have given us these high-precision maps. And what astronomers do is they apply for time at a telescope, and that telescope is directed in a particular, to a particular point in the sky, and as the Earth orbits, the telescope will be looking at one line in the sky. So this telescope will see one narrow slice of the sky. And what the astronomers do now is they focus in on all of the galaxies that they can identify in this slice they have access to. And for each galaxy they see, they try to measure its distance from us. And then they produce a map. We are here. This is distance from us. This is the direction of the sky. You can produce these cone diagrams. And these are the maps which I'm going to show you now. 15 years ago, the best available maps of the distribution of galaxies contained about 1,000 galaxies. This map is the Harvard Center for Astrophysics Retrograde Survey. So we are sitting here. This is the distance from us. This is one direction in the sky. Each point is a galaxy. And what I want to carry you away from this map is that galaxies are not randomly distributed in the sky. There are some dense clusters of galaxies, some filaments or sheets of galaxies, and some voids, some regions with almost no galaxies. Now, to impress you of how rapid the field is evolving, 5 years later, the maps contain 10 times more galaxies and probe the universe to a distance of about a factor of 5 deeper. We are now at the depth of 2 billion light years. We are here 2 billion light years away. Each point is a galaxy. You see, again, dense clusters of galaxies, filaments of galaxies, shoots of galaxies, and voids. The current state-of-the-art maps contain 100,000 galaxies, and in a couple of years it will be 1 million galaxies. And this map is now so cluttered with galaxies that you can hardly see anything. So you actually have to coarse-grain the map, select out only a subset to get a nicer map. But once again, you see the same features persisting. Dense clusters of galaxies, filaments or sheets, and voids. So this is one window to explore the universe. The maps that I've shown you until now, these maps give us the distribution of galaxies. So that's the distribution of light. And hopefully that will give us a distribution of mass as well. But recently a second window has become very prominent, a second window to measure large-scale structure. And this window is the cosmic microwave background. Cosmic microwave background. The cosmic microwave background was discovered in 1964 by two engineers at Bell Labs, Penzias and Wilson, who were working on microwave antennas to communicate with satellites. And they discovered, to their great dismay, that from each direction in the sky, there was some radiation in the microwave region coming towards us. That's the microwave background. So the first maps of the cosmic microwave background looked incredibly boring. This is not just a bad transparency, but this is exactly the kind of transparency I want to show you. So first of all, this is the projection of the celestial sphere onto a plane. It is like the projection of the surface of the Earth onto a plane. That would have the North Pole here and the South Pole here, and this would be the equator. What you do is, in each direction in the sky, you measure the intensity of the cosmic microwave background. You express the intensity in terms of an equivalent temperature, and then you plot the temperature as a function of angle. And what you find is that to a very good accuracy, the temperature of the microwave background is 2.73 degrees Kelvin in all directions. This is 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. This is very cold. It is even cold by Canadian standards. So now, in 1992, the first deviations of the temperature from isotropy were discovered. And these deviations of the temperature from isotropy are minute. They are measured in terms of 100 microkelvin. So one part in 10 to the 4 of the background temperature. So it's an incredible technological achievement to be able to measure such temperature differences which come through the noisy atmosphere from the sky. So this picture shows again the projection of the sky onto a plane. This is the northern celestial hemisphere, southern celestial hemisphere. This is the Milky Way, which forms the equator. And you see there are hot spots and cold spots of the microwave background. This is 1992. In the decade that has followed, this field of cosmic microwave background mapping has made incredible progress. This is now a slide showing results from balloon experiments. Those balloons flew in the year 2000, and they show the temperature in a small patch of the sky. You see the angular scales on the axis. Again, hot spots, cold spots of the same magnitude as before, But the IDA resolution is much nicer, much smaller. And finally, the crowning achievement to date was a WMAP satellite results that were released just about 1 year ago. This is again the projection of the celestial sphere into a plane, the north celestial pole, south celestial pole, the equator. And here you see the fine scale anisotropies in the temperature of microwave background. Beautiful map, it looks pretty. And it shows that there are anisotropies in the temperature of the microwave background. So I've now shown you two windows which we can use to map out the distribution of stuff on large scales. And let me try to identify some questions that we would like the answers to. First of all, why is the cosmic microwave background so isotropic? Isotropic to better than one part in 10,000. What is the origin of the small anisotropies that we measure? And obviously I'm going to put something in here. We have to wait for a few transparencies for that. In terms of galaxies, why are galaxies not randomly distributed? What is the origin of the specific scale that we see, the specific patterns, filaments, and voids? These are questions we would like the answers to. So now I'd like to make a slight detour on how we analyze data. For example, data like this, distribution of galaxies. I would like to compare the scientific approach with a non-scientific approach. So let's look at this picture. One approach would be to look at all bright objects and connect these bright objects with lines, call these lines constellations, and maybe even superimpose these constellations with mythical figures. Now, this is very fascinating, it's intriguing, but it is not science. So the key to the scientific approach to analyzing data like this is to quantify it. So what we do when we quantify this data is we replace this beautiful map of the distribution of galaxies, or this beautiful map of temperature map of the cosmic microwave background, we replace it by ugly map. So what we do is we take the map, we feed this map into a black box, the black box of mathematics, and from this beautiful map, we extract some boring information, namely a curve, a one-dimensional curve. Now, this black box is constructed such that the curve has the following property. If the map is uniform, then the curve will be zero. For all values of L, we will get zero. If the map is not uniform, then the curve will not be zero. If the map has some features on large scales, then this curve will be non-zero at small values of L. If the map has small scale features, the curve will be non-zero for large values of L. So this black box is constructed in a way such that we can extract information about the structure from the shape of this curve. And then what you also do is you give this curve a fancy name, for example, power spectrum, and then you're in business. So now in 1981, Alan Guth, who at that time was a struggling postdoctoral fellow without a permanent job, he invented presented a new theory of the variable universe called the inflationary universe model, and I'll explain to you later on. The key fact that I'll be telling you about now is that this theory predicted that there would be microwave anisotropies. And he got some help from astrophysicists, Sachs and Wolf, Peebles, who's a Canadian working at Princeton, Bond and Estafu. Bond is director of the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics in Toronto. They calculated this curve for him, and the curve that Allen-Wolf's theory predicted has this shape. It has a fairly flat part at small values of L, and these characteristic oscillations. So this was 1981, more than 10 years before the first microwave anisotropies were detected. When the microwave anisotropies were detected in 1992, these microwave anisotropies were only detected on large scales. And they gave you a fairly flat spectrum. And in the years following 1992, there were many interesting balloon experiments which gave information about microwave anisotropies on intermediate scales. And these are balloon experiments, which are fairly large error bars, but there seemed to be some trend that the data showed towards this peak region. After the high precision balloon experiments of the year 2000, the error bars shrunk, and these are the data with the error bars. And this is Allen-Wolf's theory. And finally, last year, this WMAP satellite, whose map results I showed you a minute ago, gave you this result for the spectrum. These are the data points, including the error bars, and this is Allen-Wolf's theory. Proposed more than, well, proposed 20 years before. As you can imagine, Alan Booth is no longer a struggling postdoc. He is now a tenured professor with holding an endowed chair at MIT. It's called alma mater. Let me now come back to this list of questions. And let me now add a couple of questions, which I can now add after having introduced the quantitative measures of large scale structure. So we would like to understand the origin of anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background. We would like to understand the reason for the scale invariance of the power spectrum for this flat portion, the small end. We would like to understand the origin of these acoustic peaks. Lots of questions. So at this stage, I hope to have convinced you that we have learned a lot about the structure of the universe on large scales. There's lots of data, some of it is high precision. Cosmology has become an observational, data-driven science. But still, we want to put this data into a theoretical framework. And what is a theoretical framework? Well, the first theoretical framework is the standard Big Bang model. So let me explain the standard Big Bang model, Big Bang. It rests on three pillars. The first pillar is Einstein's realization that space-time is not absolute. Space-time is dynamical. Matter curves space-time, as Einstein described in his theory of general relativity. So Einstein's theory of dynamical space-time replaces Newton's theory of absolute space-time. The second pillar is that space is homogeneous. isolated topic on large scales. Initially, this was just assumed to make the calculations simple. Now, based on the isotropy of the microwave background, we know that on large scales, the universe is quite homogeneous and isotropic. Now, if space is homogeneous and isotropic, and matter curves space-time, we know that there is matter in our universe. Therefore, our universe, our space has to be evolving. The only way our space can be evolving is in terms of expansion. So Einstein's theory, coupled to the assumption that space is homogeneous and isotropic, inevitably leads to the conclusion that space is expanding. Now, what does that mean? Now, what I like to show is this analogy. Imagine that space is a raisin bread, and each raisin stands for galaxy. You stick this raisin bread in the oven, the raisin bread expands. Now, what do we learn? Every raisin is at rest in the dough. Every raisin thinks it's in the center of the universe. Every raisin sees all other raisins moving away from it in radial direction. And in fact, the apparent recessional velocity is proportional to the distance. That's a prediction. So this prediction is actually, unfortunately for Einstein, not a prediction, but a post-diction, because Hubble had already discovered this. And this is recent data on recessional velocity, velocity away from us as a function of distance, showing that there's a roughly linear relationship. Each of these objects actually is not a galaxy, but a supernova, but that's a detail that's not important for us today. Also, I'd like to make a side comment. Let's take an arbitrarily small expansion rate of this raisin bread. But let's take this raisin bread to be infinite. So, for any expansion rate, as long as you go far enough away from the galaxy we live in, you will find that the recessional velocity becomes greater than the speed of light. There'll be a maximal distance beyond which the recessional velocity is greater than the speed of light. We will never see these objects. That's called the Hubble radius. So the fact that recessional velocities of certain objects are larger than the speed of light has nothing to do with some new physics of inflation. It happens in standard Big Bang cosmology. That's a common misconception even among physicists. And since there are some physicists here, let me make another side comment directed only to physicists. So this Hubble radius, this surface where the recessional velocity is equal to the speed of light, is obviously completely observer-dependent. It has nothing to do with temperature. And to associate entropy with it or something like that obviously will lead you into lots of contradictions. End of side comment. Let me go back to the pillars of standard Big Bang cosmology. There's a third pillar, namely a specification of matter. In standard Big Bang cosmology, we treat matter as a sum of ideal gases, dust and radiation, the kind of gases that we observe today. So now those of you who've taken chemistry in high school, or those of you who do lots of experiments with bicycle tires, they will know that if you compress a gas, the gas will heat up. So therefore, if we run the expanding universe backwards in time, we will find that the temperature of the universe, as we go backwards in time, the temperature goes up. And if we go sufficiently far back in time, we will reach a temperature when atoms become unstable. And here I have a sketch for what happens. So if the gas is so hot that the kinetic energy of these of the atoms becomes larger than the binding energy of the electron to the nucleus, then in a collision, the electron can be free. So at temperatures higher or at times earlier than this critical time, the time which is called time of recombination, time of last scattering, the universe consisted of a plasma of charged particles, electrons, and positively charged nuclei. And these particles were interacting by binding. And if you run the universe into the future, then you find that as the universe cools down, eventually you reach a temperature where the electrons can recombine. And this recombination process releases energy as radiation. And it is this energy which travels to us from the time of last scattering until today, and which forms the cosmic microwave background. And so indeed, a prediction of the expanding universe model is the existence of a cosmic microwave background. In fact, not only the existence of the microwave background, but that this background has a very specific shape, namely a black body distribution. I'll get back to that in a second. Now, a comment on this prediction. This prediction was first made, I think, in the 40s or 50s by Alpha, Hermann, and Gamow, but hardly anyone paid attention in the West. This realization was also made by a very famous Soviet cosmologist, Yakov Zelovich. But in the days of Zelovich, in the 50s, the Big Bang model was not accepted. In fact, the name Big Bang was considered to be a pejorative name. And Zelovich used this analysis, namely the fact that the Big Bang model would predict the cosmic microwave background. He used it against the Big Bang model, because he said, as a theoretician, he said, there is no cosmic microwave background, therefore the hot Big Bang model cannot be true. Now, in the early 60s, the professors in Princeton University, in particular Jim Peebles and Bob Dickey, they rediscovered this prediction of the existence of a cosmic microwave background, and they started building a detector to measure this microwave background. And it is these two Bell Lab engineers who serendipitously stumbled on this microwave background just around the same time and beat them to the Nobel Prize. Anyway, since at the time of recombination, not all of the atoms had exactly the same energy, therefore not all of the particles of radiation that were emitted at that time had exactly the same energy, and therefore today we should not expect all particles of the cosmic microwave background that take us to have exactly the same energy either. Their distribution should be of this shape, black body black. So this curve is intensity as a function of wavelength of the radiation. And physicists or chemists will recognize this curve as a black body curve. But this is in fact the experimental curve which the COBE satellite gave us. This is the shape of So it's a frequency distribution of the positive microwave background. Now, any good science student would immediately object and say, any observational results have to come with error bars. Where are the error bars here? When the error bars are on this curve, they are smaller than the width of this curve. Cosmology has now entered the era of high precision. The cosmic microwave background is the best black body that we know of. And I should also make a side comment on this discovery of the black body nature of the cosmic microwave background. It was not just discovered by the multi-million dollar NASA COBE satellite, but at the same time, there was a tabletop rocket experiment coming out of Vancouver, Canada, the Gush Halpin UBC experiment, which got a curve of similar accuracy. In fact, Gush and Halpin got the absolute temperature measurement better. They didn't have the money for publicity, though. So, the most spectacular success of standard Big Bang cosmology is this curve, the black body nature. Now, let's go back to the beginning of my talk. I talked about distribution of galaxies, anisotropies, inhomogeneities. Anisotropies are microwave background. I haven't mentioned these anisotropies yet. The reason I haven't mentioned anisotropies is because standard Big Bang theory cannot explain the origin of any inhomogeneities and anisotropies. So I'm now turning to the problems of standard Big Bang theory. In fact, the standard Big Bang theory cannot explain the isotropy of the microwave background, the overall isotropy. And this I'll try to illustrate with this space-time sketch. This is space. This is time. We are here looking at the microwave background radiation coming to us from opposite directions in the sky. So we can trace back the radiation to the time when it was emitted. And we can calculate this spatial distance, which is called the past light cone. We can compare it with the maximal distance that light could have communicated starting from the Big Bang in the context of standard Big Bang model. And if you do the calculation, you find that the region over which the temperature is the same, the temperature is the same here and here, but that distance is much, much bigger than the distance which could have been in causal contact at the time of the incarnation. Therefore, in standard Big Bang cosmology, there is no way to explain why the temperature here and here is even approximately the same. It's called the horizon problem. The reason why the standard Big Bang theory cannot explain the origin of inhomogeneities can also be explained in terms of a simple diagram. Again, space and time, we are here looking at some large scale. For example, scale of clusters of galaxies. Now, galaxy formation is a slow process, because it is driven by gravity, and gravity is a weak force. So if galaxies are not randomly distributed today, then the seeds that turned into the galaxies had to have been non-randomly distributed in the very early universe. And the problem is that at these very early times, the seeds which develop into today's large-scale structure were separated by more than the distance which could ever have been in causal contact, by more than the horizon. And therefore, it is not possible to imagine any theory that comes up with a mechanism to produce inhomogeneities on such a large scale. It's a causality problem. Standard Big Bang theory cannot explain the origin of inhomogeneities. The third problem, which I want to mention, is a singularity problem. If you take the equations of general relativity, which follow from the three principles that I mentioned before, then you find that 10 billion years ago, at a time that we call t equals zero, the temperature in fact was infinite. And that's called the Big Bang, time when the temperature was infinite. Now, this is a paradox. It's an inconsistency of the theory, and mathematically the existence of these singularities was proven by Hawking and Penrose. Now let me just elaborate a little bit on why I call this an inconsistency. So infinite temperature, infinite density. Our physical theories do not describe infinite temperatures, infinite densities. They break down long before we've reached infinite temperature and infinite density. The standard Big Bang model assumes that matter was described by an ideal gas. Physicists know that at sufficiently high temperatures, the universe does not behave. Matter does not behave like an ideal gas. So the equations which are used to predict the singularity have broken down long before you actually reach the singularity. There are obviously lots of philosophical problems associated with the singularity as well. What was there before the singularity? The universe is supposed to be born with infinite temperature, infinite size, infinite density at this time. It is born in what? Huge number of philosophical problems. And if you ask a physicist, the physicist just has to say, this goes beyond the limits of my theory. Let's go back to the other two questions first. Let's not try to solve the singularity problem, but let's try, first of all, to come up with a mechanism to explain the isotherapy of the microwave background and the origin of inhomogeneities. And this is Alan Guth's achievement. He invented the inflationary universe model. And the inflationary universe model is easy to describe. You take the timeline of standard Big Bang cosmology, a Big Bang, plasma-dominated phase, followed by the neutral phase we live in today, and you make a small chain. You assume that somewhere at early times, in the early phases of this plasma-dominated period, there was a time during which the universe expanded exponentially. Exponential expansion space. That's the origin of the word inflation. That's the theory. And now I'll show you that this theory automatically provides you a solution of the homogeneity problem and a possible mechanism for structural formation. First, I have to try to save my voice. So let me go back to this horizon problem. What happens if we assume that the universe expanded exponentially during a short period of time? The universe is a little bit older, but the key thing that happens is that the forward light cone gets exponentially larger than it was in standard Big Bang cosmology. So instead of the maximum distance that light could have communicated starting at the Big Bang, instead of this being a very small region, it's an exponentially larger region. So the exponential expansion of space can make this forward light cone exponentially larger than what we calculate it to be in standard cosmology, and we can easily make it sufficiently long. So nothing deep there. I'm not hiding anything. Now let's look at how this period of inflation can provide an origin for inhomogeneities. This same exponential expansion of space exponentially expands the wavelength of inhomogeneities. So if we trace the wavelength of inhomogeneities that we observe today back in the past, They seem to be very, very large on the wavelength. But during the period of inflation, this wavelength decreases exponentially as we go back. So it is very easy to arrange that all scales that we observe today in cosmology started out being microscopic in wavelength at the beginning of inflation. So inflationary cosmology potentially can solve the fluctuation problem. And let me tell you what the mechanism is. What is the mechanism that produces these fluctuations which turn into the lossless structure that we observe? So let's imagine that there's a demon who's living in this hot soup of the very old universe. Let's imagine that this demon will stir the soup at a fixed physical wavelength. The density of this soup is the same at all times. Therefore, the demon will be stirring the soup in the same way at all times, producing waves at all times. As soon as the wave has been produced, its wavelength will increase exponentially. So the demon continuously stirs the soup, continuously produces waves. These waves will redshift out of the Hubble radius, and then they will at late times enter the Hubble radius. Now, for physicists in the audience, the name of the demon is quantum vacuum fluctuations. And what happens to these quantum vacuum fluctuations is that they get squeezed when the wavelength is larger than this Hubble radius. And this squeezing is the effect that is responsible for these oscillations in the spectrum of the microwave background. The fact that the universe is time translation invariant here in inflation produces this plateau region, and this squeezing effect is responsible for these oscillations. So this is the theory of inflation. Now, how does one get inflation? Now, if you take a traditional physicist's approach, a particle physicist's approach, you will consider a better theory of matter than standard Big Bang cosmology uses. You will involve a theory that describes matter at high energies. This is so-called quantum field theory. That's not enough. You have to take a particular type of field, a so-called scalar field. No one has ever observed a scalar field in nature. Theorists have proposed many scalar fields. Now, I'm getting hungry. What you have to do is you have to take this scalar field and you have to very specially, carefully prepare it to taste. It's not enough to just take a scalar field. It has to be specially prepared, both in terms of its properties and in terms of its initial conditions. But if you do that, then you find that you get the period of inflation, the finite length in the very early universe. Finite length in the future and in the past. Finite in the past. That means that this theory of inflation does not resolve the singularity problem. Because before the onset of inflation, in this inflationary model, the universe evolves as in standard Big Bang cosmology. There was a Big Bang singularity with the same inconsistency problems as in standard Big Bang. I'm getting close to the end of my talk, and I can afford a couple of more difficult slides. Now, a second problem of inflationary cosmology is that the basic mechanism of this demon producing waves is not internally consistent. If we take this space-time diagram, space and time, which shows the evolution of wavelengths of inhomogeneities, how they travel from the very early universe to the late universe, where we observe them, then you find that all of these wavelengths emerge from the zone of ignorance, the zone where the wavelength is smaller than the Planck length or the string length, where we do not have an appropriate theory. And what we are doing when we calculate the spectral fluctuations is we extrapolate the theory unjust, without justification, it is local ignorance. And you can show that the predictions of inflation are actually not robust towards what will soon in the own ignorance. So the biggest success of inflationary cosmology, namely the fact that it explains, that it provides a mechanism for explaining inhomogeneity, is suspect. It has an Achilles heel in exactly the same way as the biggest success of standard Big Bang cosmology, namely the black body curve of the cosmic microwave background, contained its own Achilles heel. Furthermore, the basic mechanism of how we get exponential expansion in our current theories of inflation is subject to a very severe problem. In our current inflationary models, the inflationary expansion is generated by an effective cosmological constant. We do not know what the cosmological constant is. We know that any vacuum energy of quantum fields contributes a cosmological constant larger than what is admissible by observations by this extravagant fact. There's something very basic in fundamental physics that we do not understand that addresses anything that is associated with a cosmological constant, and any mechanism that relies on something that looks like a cosmological constant is subject to being invalidated once we understand what solves the cosmological constant problem. So my conclusion is that we need a new theory of the variable universe, and this will then give rise to a problem. Will it contain a Big Bang? Well, someone already gave the answer. So let's now formulate some questions for a new cosmology. Well, we should ask, will it contain inflation, or will it contain some alternative evolution in the quite early universe? If the answer is that it contains an alternative, but not inflation, we will have to construct a new mechanism of structure formation, which is consistent with all of the present observations in the same way that inflation is. It's a grand challenge, a very interesting challenge. If the answer is that the new cosmology will contain inflation, what is the mechanism of inflation? Will that mechanism contain a Big Bang? There are other questions, which I didn't emphasize in this talk, and I do want to emphasize because it's almost the end of the talk. There are many more crucial things that we do not understand in cosmology, and which this new theory ought to explain. For example, it should explain the cosmological constant problem. It should explain what the dark energy is that seems to permeate our universe. Just a few words on dark energy. Some of you have probably heard the public talk by Lawrence Krauss on dark energy. But it appears to us that 70% of the energy of the universe is dark energy, 25% is dark matter, and 5% is ordinary matter. Ordinary matter, we know. Dark matter is stuff that we have no idea what it is, but we know that it interacts gravitationally the same way as ordinary matter. So it's not that unusual. Dark energy is stuff that we have even less idea what it is. It does not interact gravitationally like ordinary matter. And it is 70% of what there is in the universe. So this is almost like the ultimate Copernican revolution. And it should give those of you food to reflect who think that physics is nearing its end. So our new cosmology ought to explain the cosmological constant problem and dark energy. It should also explain why there are only three large spatial dimensions. Why do I write down this sentence? Well, the new theory that addresses the cosmological constant problem and that will give us a new model of inflation or an alternative will probably be based on a quantum theory of space and time, and on a unified theory of all four forces of nature. And one candidate for such a theory is string theory. Now, string theory is mathematically consistent only in 9 or 10 spatial dimensions. Why do we only see 3? String theory provides an answer. Maybe none of you have heard of it, but it does provide an answer. Now, in conventional quantum gravity is usually formulated in 3 spatial dimensions. But why? You could also do it in more. Our new cosmology ought to explain why there are only 3 large spatial dimensions. You see, we are challenging more and more of our old cherished beliefs. So we have learned more than we ever knew before. We have learned more about the universe than anyone dreamed would be possible 25 years ago. But the more that we learn, the more we see we do not know. And the more we need to question. The more basic things we need to question. In fact, we need to question the existence of the Big Bang itself. Are there alternatives to the Big Bang? Let me mention a few possibilities. Past eternal inflation, bouncing cosmology, cyclic cosmology. It could be that a new model of inflation will be exponentially inflating infinitely far into the past. We do not have the mathematics which will give us that now, but this is a possibility. In fact, if this possibility were realized, it would almost be like a rebirth of the steady state scenario. The universe would look like a steady state in its early stages. A bouncing cosmology, what happens there is that the universe would start out large, it would be contracting to some finite size, then it would stop contracting and start expanding again. Conventional physics does not allow for a bouncing cosmology. Modern physics, for example, string theory, does. So bouncing cosmology is not coming. Now, if you have a bouncing cosmology, you could imagine that you keep bouncing many, many times. The universe contracts, expands with maximum size, and contracts again. That's cyclic cosmology. These are all possibilities. So at this point now, I have to turn to the students in the audience. So I hope I've shown you all how much we have learned over the past 20 years. And I hope I've formulated some questions, but I have not given you the answers. And I think it's the new generation who should take as your challenge to actually come up with the answers to the questions which are posed. And in coming up with those answers, I'll guarantee that you'll find many more challenging questions. Thank you.
Questions from the audience, and we have 2 roaming mics on both sides, one on each side, Ron.
Turn down the phone.
That's a question for us. Can you wait for a mic?
I'm just wondering what Cliff said about the length of time during which inflation took place, and it was extremely short. It was in violation of maximum light speed.
There's no violation of maximum speed of light. So I mentioned that superluminal apparent recessional velocity happens even in ordinary cosmologies. It happens on small and scale which are not small. But that's important. Now, Guth doesn't know how long inflation lasts. You can calculate how long inflation has to last in order for it to provide the solution to the problems which I indicated. That's a fairly simple calculation. And in our toy models of inflation, you find that it is very easy to get inflation to last that long. In fact, usually inflation lasts embarrassingly long, much longer than needed.
The universe is expanding. What is it expanding into? And if there is something there, how did it get there?
This question right now is beyond the realm of physical science. That is being stretched, then you have an ant on the table. This ant can detect this fact that the table is being stretched, but the ant cannot physically measure whether the table is stretched into something or not. Mathematically, you can describe surfaces which are not embedded in anything. The mathematical theory of differential geometry allows it. But back to your question, I do not know the answer. It is beyond the realm.
Good evening. The dark energy that's causing the universe to expand and accelerate as it expands, would you prefer the dark energy as a push or a pull on the universe?
So I would refer to it as something intrinsic. In fact, it's probably better it is like sticking a raisin bread into the oven, and something internally is causing it to expand. So I fear I've not answered that very well, but this is what I would say.
Just further on the context of the universe, that there is speculation, as you probably know, about multiple universes, parallel universes, etc. Maybe some of it's from science fiction, but there's perhaps some physicists and cosmologists who perhaps are going to that realm. Would you care to say anything at all in that regard?
Yeah, if you look at the scientific literature, right now there's a lot of talk about parallel universes, multiverses, all kinds of fancy words. Now, for me, there's enough unknown about our part of the universe that I do not really want to go beyond. I want to understand our part of the universe. And ideally, I would like to understand it as a unique event. I would like our universe to emerge in a natural way. I would not want a theory in which our universe is a very unusual event. But in some recent approaches, which go under the name of the anthropic approach to cosmology, our universe is really an unusual event. But I think some of the people who are talking about that have very often given up on science.
Hashtag is not
helping to get meaning. Okay, this question in the very back.
Yes, I'm betting you can answer this one. The wavelength intensity curve, why is that referred to as black body curves?
So there's a. This is a physics question. And if I'm not an easy physics question, you have a state of thermal equilibrium, And the state of thermal equilibrium predicts that the energies of particles are distributed in a very specific way. In a way, in the only way that is consistent with being independent of time. That's the black body distribution. In this black body distribution, most of the particles have to have the average energy. But there have to be some with large energies and some with smaller energies. But I think if you want more, a better explanation, you have to come up in, and we have to talk about that at the time. I even have to struggle to be able to give you a good explanation in words.
Hi. I was wondering how far the universe is expected to expand, and if it's infinite or something like that, how it's going to be fueled. Like, where is the matter going to come from to expand infinitely?
So in principle, this is an observational question. If you understand exactly how large the universe is now, how curved the universe is now, and what the expansion of the universe is now, you could answer those questions. We know now that the universe is fairly close to a state where it would expand forever, but with the rate of expansion that will gradually decrease to zero. So it is fairly close to that, but we do not know how close. But if you want a good guess is that it will expand forever, and my guess would also be that the expansion rate will slow down and will approach zero.
You talked about the age of the universe and the Big Bang being roughly 10 billion years. And the question is it 10 billion years because that's where, and I can't remember the exact name of the radius is, where the speed of light would say that's as far back as you can see now. And anything older than that we can't see yet because it hasn't reached us yet. Or is there a reason independent of observation that tells you that it's 10 billion years?
There's no reason independent of observation. But the observation has two aspects. So given the expansion rate of the universe today, and given the model, for example, the equations of standard Big Bang cosmology, you can calculate how far back in time you have to go to reach the temperature infinity. And you find that the order of magnitude is 10 billion years. The answer to that is very closely related to this radius that you mentioned, where the apparent recessional velocity becomes the speed of light. Because if the universe is 10 billion years old now, then the distance which photons are from the origin, the photons are expanding at the speed of light, is 10 billion light years.
Since we live in a galaxy, would you say, or has it been discovered, there was or is any other form of life found yet?
No other form of life has been found yet, but it's definitely a very it's a very active area of astronomy. And the big breakthrough in that area over the last 5 years is the discovery of planetary systems around other stars. In fact, planets of the size of the Earth, of a distance not too different from the distance of the Earth from our Sun. So we have made a little bit of progress towards potentially finding other forms of, well, other places in the universe where there's life, like on the Earth. But we haven't found anything.
I enjoyed your discussion. Very well done, thank you. There's been a lot of talk, at least a few months ago, about several of the major particle accelerator experiments, the one in Europe and the one specifically in America. I think it's called RIC. Is it RIC particle? Where they're trying to search for something called a quark gluon plasma. Does that solve any of the problems in the the standard Big Bang model? Would that discovery add anything to the inflationary model? Just one.
It would not add any understanding of the inflationary model. So there are lots of problems in terms of the three forces of nature which are not gravity, which a lot of questions which are not yet understood. In particular, questions about what happens at high density. And this accelerator, the RIC, relativistic heavy ion collider, would help answer some questions about how the forces other than gravity, how they behave at high densities. So it is very interesting, but it is not directly relevant to questions like the existence of the Big Bang. Another question in front.
This is a good follow-up question, I think. What kind of observations will help you solve some of the problems that you're having? So you've mentioned the large-scale structure observations. You've also mentioned the cosmic background radiation. Are there other things that you would like to have, so to speak, in your pocket, observations that you can't make now, but you would like to make?
Yes.
And what efforts are being made to get those observations?
Well, I mentioned dark matter and dark energy. Let's focus on the less ambitious, maybe dark matter. We can map out where the dark matter is by doing gravitational lensing experiments. Because like ordinary matter distorts the path of light, dark matter will also distort the path of light. So very sensitive measurements of shape distortions of galaxies will, in the next 5 years, give us high-precision maps of where the dark matter is. And that will be very valuable. Now, I would also like to see microwave maps and large-scale structure maps fed into many different types of black boxes, in particular black boxes sensitive to non-Gaussian signatures. And then I would look for specific theories of the very early universe that will produce different kinds of non-Gaussian signatures. By comparing theoretical predictions and the results of observational analysis, I would hope to make progress.
Science is predicated that we can exceed the speed of light. Is that an absolute known, or is it just possible that there is something that we don't know yet?
It would require a major change in our understanding of the physical laws if you want local velocities to be greater than the speed of light. But there are models which have that. In fact, their names for that effect, and the name is Taplon. But in fact, probably a bit surprisingly, given that I'm questioning the Big Bang, I would be a bit hesitant to question the speed of light as maximal speed. I think that's more sacred because it is better confirmed in terms of experiments that you can do in laboratories. But it's possible. It is possible, and we should keep an open mind.
May I go beyond physics? As we know, on Earth, life itself has changed the Earth. Expected on the question I have, do you think one day, even from now, perhaps life itself will alter the universe? Assuming there is life elsewhere.
I fear that your question is again going beyond physical science. As a physicist, I would say I'm not studying that. I'm giving you the answer, conservative answer, I would say no.
You said that the universe is expanding, or did expand at an exponential rate. Would there not also be an extreme amount of slowdown at that point in time? You said that at one point in time, the universe will stop expanding. What is creating the stoppage of the expansion?
Okay, so at the end of inflation, The universe doesn't suddenly stop expanding. In fact, the expansion rate, the way that the expansion rate evolves, is it remains constant for a long, long time. And it stops being constant and it starts to decrease. So at the end of inflation, there's not even a sudden jump in the expansion rate. And in most, what happens when you have expansion is that the density of matter decreases. And it is the density of matter that's driving the expansion. So as the density of matter decreases, you automatically expect the expansion rate to decrease. In fact, one of the difficulties of obtaining inflation is to have a situation where the universe expands exponentially, so you have space expanding, the density of matter seeming to decrease exponentially, but the expansion rate doesn't change. That's a difficulty. And that's why you can't get inflation with your ordinary physics. That's why you need fancy physics to get inflation. There's a question in the back, and then a question in the very front.
Hello. We talk about the possibility of there being the universe expanding forever. If we go back and look at it from the other, look at it backwards, why would there not be a... It seems to me the bouncing cosmology has more logic in that it, why would it just start once? Why would there not have been something before that? And I'm not explaining this very well.
Well, I appreciate your point, and in fact, you see that bouncing cosmology is one of the possibilities that I'm raising. So, like you could also have past eternal inflation. There's another question in the back, and please bring the microphone forward, because someone in the first row wants to ask a question.
So, what are the possibilities that the universe will eventually stop expanding and come back, instead of like a big bang, come back in a big crunch?
It is very possible, but we know that it won't happen for another 10 billion years at least. So we don't have to worry. And ultimately, it's a question of observation, which will happen. We are very close to the simple case.
In your opinion, who runs the universe? Somebody in charge, or is it an automatic pilot?
The way we describe it, it's an automatic pilot. But
who created the pilot?
It's
a chicken and egg story, isn't it?
That's what. You see, for those of you who think that science can explain everything, I think this is a good example that should let you pass.
I've got a question. If the universe started as like a point and it was infinite matter, you know, infinite density, wouldn't that produce like an infinite gravitational pull? So then how would it be expanding? I don't get that part.
You're absolutely right. If the universe started with a point, then there have to be this infinite blast that lets it expand to a large size. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But if the universe today is infinite in size, and the universe is, as far as we see, it is fairly infinite today. If it is infinite today, it was always infinite. Even at the Big Bang, it was infinite. Having an infinite space emerging suddenly with infinite density and infinite temperature makes even less sense.
Say that the bouncing cosmology theory is correct and the universe does start contracting, what would happen to the matter within the universe? Would it condense in ratio to the contracting universe, or what would you predict?
That's a very interesting question. If the universe consisted only of very small amplitude waves superimposed on a homogeneous background, then these waves would just increase in amplitude and then decrease again. But if the universe is really inhomogeneous, then what happens at the bounds is much more complicated and we do not know the answer. It might fragment. And that might be a way to get separate universes. So maybe we can take a couple more questions. One more question.
There was a report recently on the radio that suggested that from the Hubble telescope there was observations that said that the rate of expansion was in fact increasing.
But that's dark energy. That's the evidence for dark energy. In fact, it didn't say that the rate of expansion was increasing, but that the universe was, that you were entering a new inflationary period. That the expansion rate was ceasing to decrease, becoming constant.
Well, there are obviously many more questions, but I would like to thank our speaker, Dr. Brandenberger.